plática que sigue es el doctor Carlos Micael, del Instituto de Física.
Okay, well, I'm going to speak in English. I hope I don't disappoint anybody. If you have any questions, you can ask me in Spanish. Actually, it's probably going to be a mix of Spanish and English, Spanglish, that I'll be speaking today. But okay, so what I'm going to try to convince you is that the homochirality of life came about through photon-induced denaturing of DNA and RNA. And to convince you of that, first I have to describe the... Oh, sorry. I want to describe the thermodynamic dissipation theory of the origin of life. That's the framework within which I will present the theory for the homochirality of life. So first, the facts of life. Life is an irreversible thermodynamic process. And so therefore, its origin, proliferation, and evolution depends on the dissipation of a chemical potential. Okay, and the chemical potential which life dissipates today overwhelmingly is the solar photon potential. So it makes sense to consider that that was also the potential that it was dissipating at the origin of life. Okay, and we see this, for example, today, wherever there are pigments, water, and sunlight. For example, this is Lake Louise, the forest is black, so it's absorbing almost all of the light which impinges on the forest, and it's dissipating this light into heat. Okay, and in fact, about 70% of the entropy production on Earth, or the entropy production due to the interaction of Earth with its solar environment, is precisamente the absorption of light in organic pigments in water. Okay, so I'm going to make an ansatz or a proposition that RNA and DNA and the other fundamental molecules of life, these are the molecules which are in the three domains of life, you know, the archaic, the eukaryote, and the bacteria, that these fundamental molecules arose through microscopic dissipative structuring in the UVC. And why the UVC? Because at the origin of life, there didn't exist the complex biosynthetic pathways which you could produce molecules. So it had to be some form of free energy which was sufficient to break and remake covalent bonding, but not enough to ionize the particle or the molecule, because in the case you ionize the molecule, you essentially destroy it. And so it's only in the UVC region that you have this energy which is sufficient to make and break covalent bonds and not ionize the particle molecule. So before I get to the theory, I'll just describe the physical conditions as they are known today at the origin of life 3.85 thousand million years ago. And there was supposedly a lot of volcanoes which were spewing out hydrogen sulfide, water, carbon dioxide, and the oceans were very hot, about 85 degrees centigrade. And they know that from isotope ratios of oxygen in the sediments found at that time. And there was also probably a lot of asteroids and more comets which were bringing in organic material, perhaps, to the surface of the Earth. And the atmosphere is not as reducing as once thought. A lot of nitrogen, carbon dioxide, water, methane, and probably some hydrogen. But there was no oxygen and therefore no ozone. So that meant that there was a ventana or a window, no, in the atmosphere which was allowing light, intense UV light, to come in at about 260 nanometers. So what in fact did the solar spectrum look like at that time? Well, we did a calculation given the best guesses for these gases which were in the atmosphere and their pressures throughout time, and using a standard solar model for the sun. This is based on proxy stars, which are G-type stars similar to our sun in metallicity and in mass. And this standard solar model describes how the sun evolved over time. And in fact, now we're receiving about 30% more integrated intensity over the whole spectrum than at the origin of life. So this model takes into account these particular components in the atmospheres and their pressures, and considering the extinction due to these components, this is more or less what you would expect at the beginning of life as this red curve. 3.85 thousand million years ago, you get a total integrated intensity of 475 watts per meter squared. Okay, and that more or less stayed the same until about 2.9 thousand million years ago, when oxygen was began to be produced by the cyanobacteria. Okay, and what I want to draw your attention to is this little peak, is this chapati, 260 nanometers. This chapati is where the ultraviolet light is coming in, and it's being blocked here at shorter wavelengths due to the carbon dioxide, and here in the middle, it's being blocked due to aldehydes, which are the most stable components produced by ultraviolet light on these chemical constituents, which were presumably in the atmosphere at that time.
What would be those big steps?
Oh, these steps are the absorption of water. This is a rough calculation. It's not a simulation, it's really a calculation. Okay, this is absorption of water in this region. Okay, so there was actually a simulation done by Nossen et al. And what they showed is comparing the ratio of ultraviolet light in the UVC in the Archean to the present as a function of wavelength. And they found, for example, that you would get about 10 to the 30 times more ultraviolet light at 260 nanometers than we get today. And that's not so surprising because ozone stops almost all of the ultraviolet light which is coming into the Earth. And on top of that, I plotted the absorption spectrum of DNA. It absorbs just at this value at 260 nanometers. Okay, not only does DNA absorb very strongly at 260 nanometers, but it also dissipates this energy very quickly to the ground state. Okay, so you get in a photon coming in, which excites these bases. These are the bases of RNA, but the same for DNA. And this is done with femtosecond laser pulses. So they excite the molecule, and then they, with a second pulse, laser pulse, they measure the conformation of the excited state, how the excited state is decaying in time. And so for all of these bases of DNA, they find that you get sub-picosecond dissipation of the excitation, electronic excitation energy into heat. And how does it do that? Well, these bases have something what they call a conical intersection. So when you excite the molecule, it goes to an excited state, the molecule is actually deformed a little bit. So the vibrational states, they're not the same as the vibrational states on the ground state, obviously. And in fact, the vibrational states can connect with the of the excited state, can connect with the vibrational states of the ground state. And so you get a very rapid dissipation of the energy into the surrounding water molecules. So this is all on the picosecond time scale. And these are for the isolated bases, but the same thing happens when you have the bases in strand form in DNA. The two components in this second component here to the decay, besides the ultra-rapid component, which is presumably due to the base decay, we have also another component, which is due to charge transfer along the DNA or energy transfer along the DNA. So these bases are extremely rapid dissipators, and therefore they're resistant to any UV damage because it's on a time scale which is even shorter than time scale for chemical reactions to occur. Okay, and it's also an interesting fact that the non-natural tautomers of the bases have much longer lifetimes. So that means you just change a proton from one of these to another, you change a double bond to a single bond, then you get a completely different system with respect to absorption and dissipation of light. These are lifetimes for those non-natural tautomers are two or three orders of magnitude greater than it is for the natural bases. So therefore, RNA and DNA are excellent microscopic dissipative structures in the UVC. So for example, they would take a single photon in the UVC and absorb it and dissipate into about 30 or 40 photons in the red or infrared in the order of 10 to the minus 12 seconds. So how did these structures come about then? So we know in non-equilibrium thermodynamics there are these dissipative structuring which is occurring. For example, everybody knows about the hurricanes. Okay, a hurricane is a macroscopic dissipative structure which is produced by a hot ocean surface and a colder upper atmosphere, which produces this structuring spontaneously into a structure which is formed only for the only thermodynamic reason to dissipate the temperature gradient of the system. Okay, and the same with Bernard cells, that's also a temperature gradient that's being dissipated. And the Belousov-Zhabotinsky chemical interactions, which are dissipating a chemical potential over the system. Okay. So what we'd like to propose is that these bases and the other fundamental molecules of life are microscopic dissipative structures, that they actually were formed or became formed under UVC light to dissipate that very same UVC light. So we take one example, which is the production of adenine from HCN, hydrogen cyanide, using ultraviolet light. And this was actually found in 1966, but nobody at that time referred to it as a dissipative structure. And what we can see here is that a photon, well, first, this is a thermal reaction going from four molecules of hydrogen cyanide to what they call cis-dam. This is a thermal reaction, but on the absorption of a photon or UVC photon, this gets transformed into what they call transdam. And here it's just a rotation about the double covalent bonding. And this is something quite common in the interaction of light with organic molecules. This is in fact what happens in our eyes with a different molecule, which is called rotaspin. And this then goes through another thermal reactions into this imidazole and then to adenine. Okay, the steps are a little bit complicated in this, but essentially it takes absorbing four molecules in the UVC region of different wavelengths to get from 4-HCN to adenine. In water, you don't need anything else. Hydrogen cyanide with water and with light. Okay, so for these reactions, if they're absorbing their photochemical, they're absorbing a photon, so they can go uphill in energy or downhill, if you like, in entropy. They can reduce the entropy of the system because they use the or negative or the small entropy in the photon in order for this.
Adenine is chiral?
No, the DNA is chiral with the sugar base, the D ribose, but adenine itself is not chiral. When it forms a DNA structure, it's going to be chiral. And I'll get to that in a little bit later. No? Let me just take a drink here. No, it's planar molecule. It's very planar molecule. All the bases are very planar. Okay. So this structure, if you actually look at it, it's going, absorbing in different wavelength regions. There's actually three photons which are being absorbed in the UVC. And they're changing it into different molecules, which all the time move its position of the absorption spectrum towards that peak at 260 nanometers. And it's increasing the molar extinction coefficient as a function of time. You go through this, you can find more details in this article. So we believe that these structures were dissipatively constructed under this generalized chemical potential, which is the UVC photon potential, which is prevalent at Earth's surface during the Archean, when life arose. Now, not only these bases of DNA absorb at 260 nanometers, but also other fundamental molecules of life, like cofactors, amino acids, vitamins, proteins, pigments, and lipids, they're all absorbing at about 260 nanometers. So if you look at this plot, let me see if it's going to work. Yeah, if I plot these molecules, the absorption maximum of these molecules on these molecules as a function of wavelength, you know, it coincides exactly with that region of the spectrum which was entering the Earth's atmosphere and arriving at the surface in the Archean. So we believe that, in fact, most of these molecules are dissipative structures which were formed under UVC light to dissipate that very same photon potential, chemical potential, just like a hurricane is formed to dissipate the temperature gradient, which is another form of chemical potential. Okay, but not all of these molecules, these other molecules here which are listed, not all of them dissipate as rapidly as DNA. But some of them have affinity to DNA, chemical affinity. For example, tryptophan, one of the amino acids in its left form, has chemical affinity to DNA. So thereby, absorbing a photon, this tryptophan also, in fact, absorbs, as here in these amino acids, absorbs at 260 nanometers, and it fluoresces, and it has a longer decay time. But by using energy transfer, resonant energy transfer, as long as tryptophan is close enough to the basis of DNA or RNA, it can use the conical intersection of DNA to dissipate its electronic excitation energy very rapidly. And the interesting thing is that tryptophan and many of these other amino acids have chemical affinity to DNA, and not only to DNA, but to, in fact, to their DNA codons, okay, or the codons corresponding to DNA. So this is a form of information being incorporated into DNA, because the whole system together acts as a more efficient dissipator of this UVC light than the parts separate. No? If you have tryptophan separate from DNA, then it will get excited, but will stay in excited state for a long time, and you cannot absorb another photon. But if it's doing energy transfer to DNA and using the conical intersection of DNA, then the system as a whole is a greater dissipator. And so that's how information could have begun to be incorporated into DNA. And we also have a dissipation-replication relation. And that has to do with the homochirality, which I'll get to in a minute. But actually what we're saying, that those systems, for example, DNA and amino acids, which dissipate more rapidly or strongly or more efficiently, are those which are more likely to replicate. And I'll give the reason for that in a moment. So this is the scheme that we have. We call ultraviolet and temperature-assisted reproduction, or UVTAR. So the idea was that at some point, the ocean temperatures, remember I said they were about 85 degrees centigrade, and that's a very important number, because that is just more or less what the denaturing temperature of DNA is, you know, for medium-sized strands. And so when the ocean surface temperature was above 85 degrees centigrade, then you wouldn't have DNA existing in double-stranded structure, because the hydrogen bonds would be broken, the two single strands would be separated. But as soon as the ocean surface temperature dropped, then some of the bases would form single strands, and they would form double strands. And during the afternoon, for example, with ultraviolet light and also infrared light heating the ocean surface, about 3 degrees, there's a 3 degree or 4 degree cycling of the ocean surface temperature between day and night today. And so something very similar must have been happening at the origin of life. Okay. And with the absorption of these photons, these ultraviolet photons, and the dissipation into heat, that would cause DNA to disintegrate or to separate denature into two separate strands. And then at night it could extend or make a double copy of where there was only a single copy. Okay, so this is what we call template-directed autocatalytic photochemical reaction, which is occurring. It's autocatalytic because it's using this as a template to form new strands similar to itself. So therefore, replication is tied to photon dissipation or entropy production, which I think is something that the physicists would always like to put into the origin of life, now have some connection between the increase in the production of entropy and life itself. So, you might think it's just a hypothesis, but in fact, we did the experiment here with a student, Norberto. So we have an ultraviolet light, which impinges on a cuvette, which has DNA in solution, and is temperature controlled. So we can control the temperature by this power supply. And we have a spectrometer to measure the absorption. And we have also another spectrometer to measure the scattering. And these are the raw spectrums of the absorption of DNA. This is for synthetic 48 base pair DNA. It's a short oligo. And this is for yeast. And you see that there's an increase in the absorption as a function of temperature. And these are for different temperatures. And that's due, basically, the DNA denatures. And so the bases become less shielded, and they absorb more of light, ultraviolet light, in this case, in the UVC at 260 nanometers. And the same thing happens for yeast DNA. And so now we did the experiment. These are the real experiments to show that ultraviolet light can denature DNA. We brought, for example, the temperature up to 40 degrees centigrade. And then we gave some time, about half an hour, to stabilize the DNA at that temperature. And then we turned the light off and on, the ultraviolet light. And every time we turned the light off, the absorption would go down, because DNA was renaturing, at least that's our reason, our excuse. And when we turn the light on, then we get denaturing. And we saw this not only for, this is salmon sperm DNA, but also for yeast DNA, for the 48 base pair synthetic DNA, and for 25 base pair synthetic DNA. Okay, so what is the mechanism of ultraviolet denaturing of DNA? Well, first we assume that it may be due to, for example, an ultraviolet light coming in and being absorbed on one of these bases, and that energy would be distributed through a volume which was sufficient to denature DNA. And we can do the calculation, and that volume turns out to be about containing about 16 base pairs, would be sufficient to raise the temperature about 3 degrees centigrade, which would be enough at these high temperatures. These experiments were done at 65 degrees centigrade. That would be enough to denature DNA. But in fact, from some molecular dynamic simulations with another student, Adriana, here has been doing, this probably is not the basic mechanism of UVC-induced denaturing. Probably it's related to some quantum mechanical process, for example, light-induced proton transfer. If you have proton interaction, hydrogen bonding, okay, between two bases, by absorbing a photon, this hydrogen, this atom, can be shifted in its double weld hydrogen bonding potential energy surface, can be shifted to the other one. And when it does shift, that changes the charge distribution on the two bases. And changing the charge distribution is going to change the interaction, the stacking interaction between the bases. And it's going to debilitate, because in its natural state, it is stronger bound. Okay? So it's probably a quantum mechanical effect. And in fact, Linus Pauling has, in his book, The Nature of the Chemical Bond, had talked about such a photon-induced proton hydrogen bonding change. And this is, in fact, a collective effect. And so if we have one hydrogen going from one base to another, then other bases which are stacked It can also occur the same thing, so that might be a component. Anyway, what is interesting out of all this is that it's temperature dependent. So the higher the temperature, the closer you are to the denaturing temperature of DNA, the more easy it is for a photon to denature DNA into its separate strands. Okay, now to get to the homochirality, this won't take very long. But okay, so we're assuming then if the DNA is a dissipative structure and it's dissipating photons, then it has the origin of life had to occur at the ocean surface where it can be exposed to this light. Okay, and at the ocean surface, we find an interesting phenomenon. For example, the sun comes in at some angle and it's refracted, and it gets reflected or dispersed from particles or water molecules in the water, in the ocean. And then it gets reflected up towards the surface. And then if you have internal, total internal reflection at the surface, you can get a polarized light out of this circular polarized light. So the first scattering gives rise to linear polarization. And then on the second scattering, you get circular polarized light. And now it's interesting that this, the amount of circular polarization is greatest near to the surface. And it also increases with a decrease in wavelength. So the ultraviolet would be a greater circular polarization than visible light. And for example, for visible light, they've measured it, and it turns out to be about 5%. So you can get 5% component in the circular polarization of light at the surface. This is the submarine light. And the interesting fact also is that DNA has this negative circular dichroism. So it's absorbing more right-handed light than left-handed. And for example, in the afternoon, from a given direction, we would see right-handed circularly polarized light is 5% extra. But in the morning, you would see left-hand circular polarized light. So it's symmetric, and you wouldn't get any positive effect. But the fact that the ocean temperature is increasing during the day, and it's warmer in the afternoon, so you get more likely denaturing in the afternoon than in the morning, okay? And so we can do the calculation. We take into account a very simple recursion relation, in where the number of left-hand molecules, or DNA, depends in a given day, depends on the number in the previous day, and the amount of photons, whether they're left or right-handed, which were absorbed by that left-handed DNA. Okay, and we do the same for the right-handed. And C is some kind of a parameter which measures the quantum efficiency for denaturing through this mechanism. Okay, and we assume, for example, that we get only one in 1,000 photons causing this denaturing. Okay, so we put, for example, C equal to 0.001. And with these amounts of right circular polarized light, excess in the afternoon, and the right-hand circular dichroism, which have been measured in the laboratory, 0.07% for DNA. And then just assuming there was no denaturing in the morning because the temperature of the ocean surface was not sufficient to cause the denaturing, and then calculating the homochirality, we can find that in about 8,000 years, we would get 100% homochirality through this photon-induced denaturing of DNA. Now, this is just in accordance with the amount of the number of photons which were absorbed by the DNA. But if we include threshold, energy threshold, for example, we know that hydrogen bonding between the two strands, so we need a certain amount of energy in order to break those bonds. So we put an energy threshold on this process, and then we can get homochirality occurring in about 800 years, which is nothing, no, as compared to the origin of life. In fact, life has been under the UVC potential, photochemical potential, for 1,000 million years since its origin, till about 2.9 thousand million years ago when the oxygen started increasing in the environment. And so you might be wondering, well, why left-handed tryptophan with right-handed DNA? Well, it turns out there's a stereochemical effect, which is one component. But I think the most interesting component is that when you measure the circular dichroism of right-handed DNA with left-handed tryptophan, for example, you find it becomes even more negative, around 260. So this process would be further increased, that is, the selection of the chirality would be further enhanced by this association of tryptophan with DNA. Okay, so that's all the conclusions. I won't read them, but I would like to acknowledge the students. There have been now 12 students. Some of them are here that have been working on different aspects. Norberto helped a lot in the experiments. He was essential for the experiments. And Adriana has been doing a lot of work on Monte Carlo molecular dynamic simulations of denaturing. Okay, so I'll leave it if there's any questions. Sure.
Yes, Tom. I don't understand very well.
Okay.
Two things. Uh-huh. One thing is, you say, well, your idea is there's an asymmetric photo destruction of DNA.
Yes.
And that could be the reason for homochirality.
Yeah.
They say to generate or to get DNA, you already have to have some kind of homochirality. That's
no. Well, to generate DNA as we know it today, but they could have existed, and they probably existed, as you know from chemistry, that there are equal amounts of right and left-handed DNA, you know, the produced by some. If it was produced by a chemical or photochemical process, we would expect that.
Okay, if you have, for example, racemic reverse. If you check, because I have my doubts, if you want really to make DNA out from a racemic sugar tool,
Okay, well, what we're saying is that these bases, okay, the bases are not racemic. Okay, and so these would have been produced first, and they would have been floating on the ocean surface, and they would have been dissipating ultraviolet light even without DNA. So why would they form, for example, a strand of DNA, or whether it's mixed chirality or single chirality, why would that happen? And there's a thermodynamic reason and a non-equilibrium thermodynamic reason. The thermodynamic reason is that the bases are less propense to hydrolysis if they are in strand form, if there's the phosphodiester bond between the bases. And the non-equilibrium thermodynamic reason is that once you have the strand of DNA, you have these codons, no? So you have a codon, a set of three base pairs. And that three base pairs has chemical affinity to these other molecules, which can also absorb. So these are like antenna molecules. And antenna molecules are very common in life today, no? We know that in photosynthetic system, we have a lot of molecules which act as antennas for the photosynthetic system, no? So these are like acting as antennas, and that is the non-equilibrium thermodynamic reason for them to form into a stranded. But when they form stranded, they can form mixed chirality. But the problem is, if you have mixed chirality, then you cannot extend it. It's very difficult to extend the DNA during the night, no? or in the laboratory, whatever. No? This extension here, if they become mixed. Okay, so the idea is that these oligos were probably around, existing long before the origin of life. No? We see that this all you need is hydrogen cyanide, water, and photons to produce adenine and the other bases. Okay, so there's many steps here which is still to be worked out.
It's quite new point. I must say, because everything which is really more or less common sense is that formation of biomolecules like DNA and others is almost the course of, let's say, of a racemic, from a racemic starting, and that's what you say, more or less.
No, what I'm saying is that there were all types that were, it was racemic at the beginning. It must have been racemic or very close to it anyway. No? And now what's happening is that these, whether they're racemic, they started piling up and forming these single strands, whether they were racemic or not. That piling up was useful for a number of thermodynamic reasons. And the basic reason would be to increase the dissipation, you know, and stop the hydrolysis of these bases. Okay, and so these strands must have existed in different chiral forms, but they eventually got selected out by this mechanism, you know, with the absorption of ultraviolet light.
And finally, second point is, there's more question. Okay. If you take the Earth as whole, the southern part, the northern part, and the CPL, statistically, I think it does not depend on day and night. No,
There is symmetry. For example, if we're in the northern hemisphere, then we see the sun in this direction, right? But if we're in the southern hemisphere, we'll see it in the other direction. So if you're looking from one, whether you're in the north or the south, it would be different. So you get different chirality, but life started in some region. It probably started in some region, and this region may have been that coincided. If you try to average it out over the total, it would nullify, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Le agradecemos al doctor y estamos al siguiente conferencia.